I'm Pastor Joanne Richmond, and this week I'm serving here at Holden Village as the village philosopher. One of my responsibilities in this capacity is to facilitate our forums. This evening's topic is everything you wanted to know about disabilities but were afraid to ask. We have various people in the community this week with various disabilities, and we're going to introduce some of those people to you, and they're going to tell us their stories a little bit, and we'll hopefully have some time then to ask questions, if you have questions, and discuss what's been presented to us. One thing I would like to ask you to do when it's time to ask questions or share comments, if you would please, if you have something you'd like to share, please raise your hand. What that does is, first of all, it'll help me keep order in trying to field questions. Secondly, it helps people who have hearing disabilities to they'll be able to see, because I'm going to point to, you're going to raise your hand, and they'll see who it is that's speaking. Okay. Right now I want to introduce to you the other person who's facilitating this evening's forum, and that is Carol Storch, and she has been working with the theme that we're working on this week.
Joanne and I talked yesterday, and she asked if maybe I would talk a little very briefly about how the hearing impaired week got started, and that goes back to 1980. I was working on staff here in the kitchen, met another teacher of the hearing impaired, and we talked about it's too bad that Holden isn't more accessible to hearing impaired people just by having interpreters here. So we talked to John Schramm, who was director at that time, and he said, fine, if somebody would like to, you know, take on that responsibility. So we did. And so in 1981, we started our first hearing impaired week, and we've had one ever since. And so that's kind of the result of that beginning. What I've asked the people that are here on the panel, if they would be willing to share just very briefly about themselves, anything that they would like to tell you, and a chance to maybe for you to get to know them a little bit better. And then I'd like to leave a fair bit of time for question and answers so that you can, you know, participate in that as well. I'm a teacher, so it's real hard for me just to call on people, because I, as a kid, never liked to be called on, be put on the spot. So I guess I would prefer to open it up and just ask if someone on the panel would maybe like to open it up and start and let it go from there, and then we'll just see what happens. Okay, Beth Walker.
Want me to start? Do you want me to begin then? Okay, my name is Beth Walker, and I'm from West Chester, Pennsylvania. And I became deaf at the age of 6 1/2 from spinal meningitis. I've worked as a church assistant for the Deaf Lutheran Church in Pennsylvania for 5 years. And I've taught junior high school in Pennsylvania for the deaf in Pennsylvania also. And now I'm a mother also, and I'm here.
Pastor Ludwig.
I am William Ludwig. I was born at the wrong time, during the Depression time. And so my parents needed to save money, and hospital bills were very high. And They took me to my aunt's home. So when I was born in my aunt's home, and then a month after I was born, I had a terrible illness. I had the measles and pneumonia. and I almost lost my life, but I lost my hearing instead. So I went to the deaf school all of my life, and then I graduated from Gallaudet College. After that, I went to seminary in Springfield, Illinois, and I graduated with a master's degree. And then I've been a pastor for the deaf, I can't read them sideways, in Columbus, Ohio, for 12 years, and in Seattle, Washington for 18 years. I'm married. I not only have three married children, but I also have three grandchildren. That's all.
Another volunteer?
My name
is
What do you want to voice for me, or?
Or do you want to voice yourself? Oh, great.
Oh, voice yourself.
My name is Elroy Trimel. I'm not a good speller. First of all, before I left the room, died with Bill, born in 1931, depression time. Became deaf, or I should say hard of hearing, at age 7. Had scarlet fever. Complete loss in one ear. 80% loss in the other ear. Fortunately, well, maybe not so fortunately, at that time there were no hearing aids. So I went to a deaf school for 5 years, completely oral lip reading. They caught you signing.
Yeah.
And after the war, World War II, hearing aids were invented. Fortunately, my hearing that was left was in the voice ring. So I was able to go back public hearing school, finished high school, University of Wisconsin, graduated as a chemical engineer, moved to the East Coast, worked with DuPont 31 years, retired, got bored. Back to work for the state, so now I'm a computer programmer for the state of Delaware.
Okay.
I should probably say one more thing. During the time I was in deaf school for the 5 years, I was very fortunate. My teacher kept challenging me to do all I could. I was not allowed to fall behind. There's many, many deaf kids are not that fortunate. They're all kept on the same level. My teacher challenged me. Before I went back to hearing school, I was able to get right in without any problems.
I don't know if I should use my voice, Miss Sarah, because I can't hear my voice.
We can understand.
Yeah. You can hear me back there? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I lost my hearing when I was 7. It's part of me, Jack. I I remember waking up in the hospital. I remember waking up in the hospital. And my mother was kneeling by my bed, praying. She had just lost my little sister and buried her. And but the doctor told me I would die, and I woke up. And there she was. And when she saw me, she started talking. I said, "Mother, why aren't you talking out loud?" I was angry. "Why don't you talk out loud?" That was the first experience I had. I asked God, well, I was the only deaf person in my family. I was in first grade. That same year, a school for the deaf opened, a one-room school opened. I went there until the ninth grade. I transferred to a hearing high school. I finished 4 years in hearing high school before I could go to college. I met my sweetheart, we married, moved to Detroit. We raised 5 hearing children. I could write a book about my life raising 5 hearing children. Maybe someday I will. It's interesting. I'm at an interesting point. Elroy, Beth and I, all 3 of us, had language before we lost our hearing.
Another volunteer?
My name is Ann Brown.
My
mother. My name is Ann Browning, and my mother, when I was born, said that because God is love, that she would name me Love. So my name is Anna Love Brown. And she took me to church every Sunday when I was a small baby. I remember when I could sit on her shoulder and look over at people. And God has always blessed my life. I am now 85. Well, I will be soon 85 in a week. And I have 7 children. This is number 4. And I have 35 grandchildren. 35 grandchildren. 87 great grandchildren. And 5 great great grandchildren. And I have all.
Let me go on.
Yes.
I have always been a lover of God. And I've always gone to church all my life. I've always carried my children to church. As a result, I have some fine, good children, all good with 7 children. And that perhaps is being proud of that, but I give all the thanks to God for that. And I've always been very honest, truthful. I'm not bragging about that. But about 4 months ago, I was in my barn climbing up a ladder, and I wasn't looking up. I had my arms like that, and a small white animal fell down right on my arm, right there, not like that. It had white fur that long. It has a tail that long. Got that big, real lots of fur. And that tail slipped down my face.
Oh.
The animal slipped down onto the floor, right across the barn. And I, I just looked at the animal. I couldn't believe it. It was a white skunk with a black stripe down his back. And nobody would believe it. I tell you about that skunk. You must have been dreaming. I told people near me about that skunk, a white skunk. Everybody said, but I was telling the truth. Then one man living across the road told me, if you go to the East Coast, you will see white skunk with black stripes. They name them civet cats. Thank you.
Someone else want to share a story?
Hey!
Okay.
It's hard to, for us to know how many people there are and when we're getting the clues.
Oh, okay.
My name is Carl Martin, and I'm from Livermore, California. I am partially sighted. Blind in the right eye and probably 10% sight in the left. I grew up pretty much sighted normally and began to have a problem when I was in late high school years and early college years with glaucoma to the point that I couldn't read on my own or couldn't drive a car and had to start depending on recorded materials and that sort of thing to do my college work. I graduated, got a teaching credential and a master's degree, and began teaching high school science and mathematics, and have been doing that ever since, and now teach physics and chemistry at a high school in Livermore, California, and I've been there for about 25 years.
Thank you.
David?
My name is David Basden. I'm from the vicinity of Fresno, California. I've been visually impaired since I was born, a congenital disease that causes a weakness of the blood vessels in the retina of the eye. It's a progressive disease. I became legally blind at the age of 10. Legal blindness, you may not know, but be legally classified as blind, your vision must be 20/200 or worse. Mm-hmm. 20/200 means that I could see at 20 feet, when most people can see at 200 feet. I've been totally blind for about the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. I went through normal schooling. I guess it's called mainstreaming now. At the time that I was going through school, there wasn't any such term. I've always been blessed with the ability to do well in school, so it wasn't a serious problem for me to go through the normal classroom situation. I, of course, had to do a few things differently because I wasn't able to read as fast in the early years or to read at all in the later years. I finished a bachelor's degree and a PhD in psychology, and I teach at California State University Fresno and have for the last 20 years in the psychology department. My area of research interest is in the fundamental nature of human memory. I teach classes in statistics and research design and computer applications. And I'd like to say that I don't very often think of myself as being disabled. I know that I am by the definitions, but I know that I have to do things differently from other people, being blind. I have to find other ways of doing what most people can do the easy way. But for me, it's mostly a nuisance that I'm forced to struggle a little bit harder, but I don't stop to think about the fact that I'm disabled. I probably go weeks and weeks without even thinking about the fact that I'm blind. I'm too busy with other things that concern me. And I'm kind of pleased with that. I don't dwell on the fact that I'm blind. I don't really think of myself as handicapped. I guess that's all.
Valerie prepared her talk, and I'm going to speak for her, and then she will communicate the last part herself. My name is Valerie Lauder. I was born with cerebral palsy. I cannot speak, and I am hearing impaired. I need help to walk and with eating. I can read lips if you speak slowly and clearly. I love to travel. I went to France once, and another time I went to England. I have lived in L'Arche, Victoria, for 7 years. And I love Jesus. And meeting new people. I also love to go to school. I communicate with a Bliss symbol board. I need you to be patient when talking to me, as it takes me a long time to communicate. Goodwill, polishing silver, and unraveling yarn. A teacher.
am also a role model and help to teach a four-year-old girl bliss symbolics. Thank you. Lynn?
My name is Leonard Crystal. I'm from northeastern part of Wisconsin, Green Bay, to be specific. I was born in 1929, November 20th, 1940, Thanksgiving Day, the only time that Thanksgiving Day has not been the last Thursday of the month, proclaimed by President Roosevelt at the time, so I can remember what happened, or when it happened. I lost the use of my arms through poliomyelitis. As one of the gentlemen alongside of me said, he doesn't think of himself as handicapped. My handicap involves my upper extremities, in other words, my arms. I have no use of the right arm, which is referred to in the medical trade as a flail. The left arm has 15% use of it, which with the motor vehicle department says that I have enough use of the arm to handle a car. My car is not equipped with any special equipment other than a spinner knob on it, unless it means there's some physical problems that I have with the starter, which I moved around. But most of the time when I've got a car, somebody gets in, they don't know that it's equipped for a handicapped person. As long as I've got power steering, automatic transmission, there's no problem. I worked for 36 years with the firm I'm with now. On a part-time basis, I worked for 23 years as a chaperone and teenage dances for the YMCA. I've also been involved with service club work at the Y, where we raise money to build buildings and equipment at the youth camp, which the service club founded back in 1937. The girls around the office, some of them go to hand me something. Oh, I forgot you were handicapped. They don't realize, think of it as handicapped, that I'm handicapped. I'm involved in all kinds of party planning and other things in the work. I've been involved with church youth work when it was the Walther League in the Missouri Synod. I was involved with Lutheran Layman's League in fact, I'm still on the district board as one of the minor officials on the district board of North Wisconsin Upper Michigan District. I haven't been attending meetings lately or been very really active in it. But the company sort of honored me back in February for doing my job. And then the following month, they interviewed me for handicap in the workplace. And my thoughts were pretty much the way the rest of them thought throughout, that they were just doing their job. We may be physically handicapped in some ways, but everybody somewhere along the line has a handicap. We compensate for it in different ways. Some of us, we can't see, we can feel. Some of us, if we can't hear, we use our mind to be alert and do things. As we were talking outside, I said, what do you do when you answer telephone? You've got one hand, you've got the telephone in the hand, you've got to write a message down. And if you don't get it down and transcribe it after you get your form of shorthand down or write it out longhand, you usually don't have time to write it your form of shorthand. Then you go back and you have to use your mind. A lot of people, I see things when I'm walking or driving that other people don't see, and then they ask about, well, where is that? Or something. Your eyes, your ears have to keep going, otherwise you're lost. And whether you're a hearing person who doesn't have a handicap or does have a handicap, you compensate somewhere along the line. When the biggest problem I have is when I say, somebody asks me a question and I say, no, I don't need any help. Or I don't want something. Like if you go visiting somewhere and they got to offer a drink and you say no, they just can't seem to take the word no for no. And this is the biggest part problem of most of the people in society today. If they listen, and when somebody says no, take it as no at that point. I have a mouth. I can ask for something if I want something later on. And I don't feel hurt if people look at me. It used to bother me, but I don't anymore. My haircut also is something that people comment on. It's a natural, another physical problem because it's a nervous problem. I was doing some Lutheran Langlands League work up in Upper Michigan. We pull up into this home, beautiful home, sitting up on the side of a mountain, and it was from here to the chalet down there to walk up to the house, and the gentleman walked out on the steps. And I think for 4 miles in any direction, you could have heard him. Because the first thing he said when I stepped out of the car, he said, I like your haircut. Because he had one just like it. And I look at it, God made a few perfect heads, the rest he covered up with hair.
Thank you. At this time, I think before we open the session to questions, I'd like to ask you to join me in applause, either clapping or like this, to thank these people for introducing themselves to us. Okay? At this time, if you have comments or questions, we would be happy for you to share with us or ask the question. Please remember to raise your hand and I'll call on you. You can direct your question or comment to a specific person if you'd like to do that, or it can be general. Yes.
I just have a question for anybody to answer, which is people's feelings about language around disability. I think in our state, in Minnesota, the recently accepted wording is differently abled. And I hear disability, I hear handicapped, I hear differently abled. And I'm a social worker and try to be so tuned into language, as Christian also tuned into language. And I know there's some disagreement, and I'd like to hear just some discussion about that from folks.
Is there anyone who'd like to begin to answer that?
Can I dovetail on that also in the distinction between hearing impaired and deaf? Is that a similar question?
Beth.
To answer the last part, the last question first, for me, hearing impaired includes a wide spectrum of hearing loss, hard of hearing to completely deaf people like I am. For me, hearing impaired is that includes everyone with impairment. So that's my answer to that part. To the first question, about which word do you use for disability and handicap, physically challenged, or whatever, I don't think anybody would really agree with this and with each other. We all have our different preferences for what word to use. I guess, first of all, we want to be considered your equal. And not to have labels. Like some of you have red hair, and some of you have brown hair, and some of you have blonde hair, and some can hear, and some can't, and some people can see, and some people can't. We're all part of the norm. Anybody else have other thoughts? Okay. I'm not going to voice for myself this time. Okay, in Michigan, we have a legal definition for deafness.
What is that?
Okay.
We had to have
a legal definition for deafness to pass new laws for the deaf in Michigan. Now, if I remember correctly, the legal definition is a person who can't make use of any hearing aids, lip reading, or other means of communication. That's not the exact wording of the definition, however, but there's a lot of difference between between deafness and being hard of hearing or hearing impaired. But we're included in the hearing impaired also. We had to have a special definition for deafness, and that was passed for the passing the laws in Michigan, and it's starting to spread all over now. Deaf.
Yes.
I have another question for really anyone on the panel, and that is, I was just wondering how you felt about mainstreaming as opposed to maintaining your deaf community or your blind community or deaf schools or blind schools, and where you personally find that balance.
Wow. That is a very tough question, especially for the deaf. Maybe some of you here know about the new public law, 94, what is it, 142? So that law is very fine for various disabled people. It's fine. The only problem is with the deaf. The problem is for communication reasons. Okay. For communication reasons. When a deaf person is put into a mainstream school, they're finding that many teachers in the public schools are not properly educated or skilled or have the expertise with the deaf. As a result, there's a large percentage of the deaf who really are not properly educated in the mainstream. Therefore, it's natural then to have the NAD working to amend this law. I'm not exactly sure what the amendment is exactly. However, the National Association of the Deaf, the NAD, is working on it. Trying to, I really don't know myself exactly, because I'm not in Washington, D.C. I live in Seattle, Washington, and it's very far away from there. I don't know exactly what's happening in Washington, D.C. daily, but I feel that I don't have the authority to speak about this, but deaf leaders are working to see that either we put some deaf In the state schools again, or we really give them qualified education in the public school. Somebody else would like to add something? Yeah. Even though I was mainstream all of my life, I went to a Lutheran college, went to a hearing graduate school, and all of that. I still feel that the mainstreaming law is discriminatory to many people in the ways that the law is interpreted. It gives the power to the schools, the government, but not to the deaf people and the parents of the deaf. I'm speaking about the deaf. I'm not talking about the blind or other groups. They might have a different point of view. But that law requires that kids are mainstream first. And if that fails, then kids can go into the deaf residential school later. And often it's too late. As a teacher, that's very frustrating for me because all kids, all deaf kids, need to learn language first.
The primary years for language are early, from up to age 10.
Go ahead, go for it.
Okay, and the teachers are unqualified, and maybe they can't sign very well, or maybe they're forcing kids to speak, or a number of things that are happening, and the kids aren't learning language at the right time, and it's being extended, and the education process is being postponed, and it's very frustrating. Mainstreaming can work very well for some people like me, who were born deaf, but for others, well, it can be bad information.
Okay.
The National Association of the Deaf feels very strongly that the deaf child is losing out. They're really trying to change that. 94-142. Because it's supposed to be, it's supposed to mean put the disabled child into a least restrictive environment.
But for the deaf child,
we feel very strongly that something has to change about that for the deaf. I would like to hear your feelings, you two gentlemen.
Directly towards the two, okay.
It's hard to say because most of my education occurred before I had a visual problem that was very acute. And once my eyesight was poor enough so that I needed assistance, I think at that point, just the availability of resources and equipment was the most important. And I think if those are available and in sufficient quantity and the right kind of equipment and advice, I think it's very possible to, if there are no other problems, to stay in public school. I don't think there's any problem whatsoever because an awful lot of the education is verbal. And we don't have that problem. We don't have a problem with lectures and things like that. And occasionally there's a problem with the visual education, but it's surprising how often that really doesn't matter all that much, unless you get teachers that stand up in front of the room and write something on the board and say, this is very important and please remember it. I think for blind people and visually impaired, probably mainstreaming is reasonable with proper support. Dave?
I haven't had much experience outside of mainstreaming. I was in a class for the visually impaired for a couple of months in the fourth grade just to see what it was like. And I didn't really feel as though I was getting the education I was getting in the regular school, so I voluntarily went back to a regular school and stayed there. I think if at all possible, mainstreaming is very important for two reasons. One reason is that it gets the child accustomed to the problems he's going to have to face in the real world. If he's set aside a special school where he's only with other people that have the same problems, he doesn't learn to get along in normal society. I think that's bad. And the other thing I think is bad about it is that people in society don't get used to the problems of the handicapped, that they never face people who are blind or deaf, and then when they run across them, they're frightened by it. They don't know what to do with people who have handicaps. Carl and I both have problems with people in strange situations, thinking that we're wild men of Borneo, that we're going to run around and pillage and ravage and destroy or something, you know. The mothers grab their children to their bosoms until they're out of sight. And that's because they never experienced it. You know, in the environment that Carl and I work in, where we're used to the people that are around us, there's no problem. They all understand our limitations and our strengths as well. And they don't generalize beyond the limitations we have, but in the broader society where people aren't used to blind people, we run into some difficulties. And I think that's a function of so many handicapped people being isolated and protecting society from them or them from society. I don't quite understand. I think mainstreaming is important for that reason. But of course, the education is primary. And if you can't get an adequate education mainstreaming for the deaf, then the important thing is to get the child educated. But I take all measures possible to try to do it in a mainstreaming atmosphere. I think it would be much better for the child if it could be done that way. But if it can't, then it can't.
Okay, we've got several hands up now, so I want to try and address those. And why don't you back behind? Okay.
Yeah, I really want to speak to the public law 94-142 in a couple of ways. What he's saying has so much relevance as far as for society. Right now, it's a relatively new law, and so we're not going to see the results of that in society for another however many years, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years. But from our own experience with our child being mainstreamed, and I'm speaking of a retarded child here, which you'll notice there's no retarded person who's been able to speak out. And that in itself is a whole story, you know, but because they're like a silent bunch, okay, because they can't verbalize. The thing they have the least of is verbal abilities, usually, often. But speaking about the rest of society, it's a very, very lonely existence to be handicapped in a lot of ways because you are isolated in certain ways. And so what happens when a child is mainstreamed is that, in our case, all these children have grown up with our daughter from grade one, and we see this ever-widening circle of people who just think of her as another kid. They're aware of the fact that she's retarded, that she's different. They know about what Down syndrome is now. They know how a Down syndrome person looks. What this all means is that when she's older, she and little children in our schools who are in wheelchairs for a variety of reasons are probably going to be spoken to by their peers. They're not going to be looked upon as being frightening, like you were saying, somebody to avoid and walk around, because they know that they're people too, and they play ball and they play games with them and all that good stuff. So that's the reason mainstreaming is, that's one of the big things about mainstreaming, it's good for everybody. Now, the other thing I like to say is that so much like the federal government, they're under a lot of pressure, they have all these pressure groups on them, and so they pass these laws. They always want to leave safety valves so they don't hurt anybody's feelings. And this is what happened with 94-142. They passed this law, but apparently left it so that school districts, most of the school districts follow the law in what's known as the letter of the law, but not in the spirit of the law. We happen to be very richly blessed in that we happen to move to a school district when we were pregnant with this child, unbeknownst to us of her condition, of course, that was following this law to the spirit as well as the letter, and it's very rare. But the blind people, if their school district were following this law as was intended, they would in fact be having all of the blind people attended to properly. They would not be in rooms where they didn't have someone who could deal with them as they should be dealt with. In other words, having, you know, I mean, obviously the whole classroom isn't going to be able to sign right off the bat. Lots of children are learning sign language now, you know, but anyway, that's the way it should be done, and I agree with him. That's what should happen, you know, first. Ideally would be that what's happening all over the country is that these kids, including Down syndrome kids, are being placed in classrooms and they don't have individual aides. The school district says, sure, that's okay, they want a mainstreaming, we'll put them in the mainstream. They know that the kid isn't going to be able to make it at all. And so then they say, well, this isn't going to work, and they take them out and put them in an enclosed classroom, and that's their excuse because they won't commit the funds. Costs a lot of money to have private aides. There's federal funding for this if you have people who will simply write out the grants, but they're not committed enough, again, because of the prejudice. They don't care enough. They haven't been made to care enough. But they could do this, and they should have personal aides. Our daughter has had her own full-time aide in a regular classroom with normal children ever since she was in the first grade. And that's the way it should be. And that's the way it should be with deaf people, too.
Okay. There was a hand over here for quite a while, Joanne.
I want to direct a question to the deaf about language and education again. I know there's a controversy now about, or maybe it's been for a while, about the differences between oral, manual, and total communication. Oral meaning learning to voice, manual meaning just sign, and total meaning both. And I was just wondering their opinions on that. What's the best thing for kids?
Yeah.
Okay. Using what fits best with that kid. It's not the teacher's opinion. It's not the opinion what fits. It's the opinion what fits best with that kid. What works best for him, that's the best. Okay.
There was a...
Really?
Sure, mainstreaming. It's very successful for some people, for some deaf people. But not the majority. If they choose it. Did you choose it?
Mainstreaming?
Did you choose it yourself, Beth? Well,
I didn't.
My parents. Yes, your parents chose it.
The parents
chose
it.
The parents
chose it.
You
don't have much
to
say about it until it's
older. You don't have much say about it until you're older.
I remember when I was in high school. I was the only deaf person there. It wasn't so bad because I had language background. But I was lonely because I couldn't participate in the debating. I couldn't participate in many things in the classroom. When someone was talking in the back. So much of the learning in the classroom, listening to the others, you know. It was lonely. But it was good for me, I guess.
Oh, I'd like to respond more to that person, whomever asked that question. Okay. I was born hearing, and my parents put me in an oral program, which was fine, but it was still frustrating. And I think that my feeling about the oral programs, kind of, if it fits best with people who have some hearing left, who are hard of hearing, it fits best for those people. But for most average deaf person, the oral program really, well, it's really for society's benefit, you know, so that we can become normal, so to speak. And I chose to learn sign language to broaden my world, to give me access to the many things that I didn't have access to. In graduate school, with an interpreter, I had accessibility. And still I use my voice still when I'm talking. I still sign. But still, it still sticks with me that kids need to inform us what's best for them, for him or her.
There was one up there for a long time, but why don't you go first?
I have a question I'd like to, a more practical question that I'd like to address both to Anna and to Beth. What does a non-hearing parent do for a crying baby in the middle of the night? Or any time?
Beth?
Yeah. Well, me, my baby is 7 weeks old now. And I have the baby sleep right next to me. And he lets me know when he's crying. And I wake up. And I have become very sensitive to that, yeah. During the daytime, I have a baby cry light. When I'm in the other room, and the baby's asleep in another room, and he starts crying, the light flashes.
The baby slept with me.
I had the baby between my husband and me,
and I was afraid that I would roll over them, but I never rolled over on them.
All the great stuff was
there. And the baby would always wake me up.
I did eight of them that way.
I never heard them, but they would move, and I knew, and I would wake up.
Yes. Okay, there's a question up there.
This is more of a general comment back on the subject of PL9 for 1.2. And I'm speaking as a teacher with both special ed background and regular ed. And I can't emphasize enough that I think that law will never be able to be carried out to the intent of the law rather than just the letter of the law until teachers are trained in how to accommodate all students in the classroom. And I think that's really lacking right now. On a district level and also at the university level, when people are going through initial teacher training programs, there really are no provisions made unless you specifically seek special ed training. And I think it should be required at that level, and also that districts provide that training for teachers, because most teachers want to be able to provide that kind of environment but do not have the knowledge to do that and feel very overwhelmed by it.
Okay, yes.
I'm hearing all these things, and I'm wondering how we can lobby, how can we plug into lobbying efforts being made in Washington, D.C. and be aware of these things so we can write letters and, you know, is there associations or is there newsletters? How do we tap into this?
Do you have an answer to that question?
Yeah, sort of.
Okay, you answer first.
Okay. One thing that you can do on a local kind of grassroots level for immediate problems is if you have a child that's not getting the services that you think they should be doing, you can get a parents group together, the PTA, whatever, and you can confront the school board or whoever you should be confronting, and you can challenge them on it because by law they're supposed to provide certain services. There's many special services that are listed in Public Law 94-142. And a lot of people aren't aware of all of them. Music therapy is one of them. So you just, on a real grassroots, case-by-case basis, can get groups of support together.
Do you have more to add to that?
Oh, I think I used my head nasty. She was talking about the baby a lot. I just wanted to say, our homes are way white for sound. We had lights flash when the telephone rings, lights flash. the doorbell rings, and now the baby crying out. So we're sitting for it.
Okay, I wanted to respond to whomever asked that question. Okay. President Bush recently selected a hearing impaired man, Robert
Davila,
to handle special education. Anyway, a special education group in Washington, D.C., and he is put in, he has put in a strong word for what we need and what we want. And so that's one place also that you can, things can get started. He's with HEW, is that true?
Used to be Hugh.
Used to be Hugh.
Okay, I've got 10 o'clock. So it's time to wrap up. I think that many conversations have just begun. I would like to encourage all of you to engage any of these individuals in conversation outside the forum, anywhere here at Holden. I'm sure we're all open to continuing the dialogue. I want to thank all of the people on our panel and thank all of you for coming and entering into this discussion. Okay.